My name is Mark Johnson, and today's session has the enigmatic title of People as Geology. What could that mean? It's one of the objects of being on teaching staff here that you have to come up with titles that are kind of weird and confusing, so that it puts the teachers at an advantage because you come in kind of confused and you have this. What I want to talk about today is a little bit afield from where I am as a geologist. I teach in the Midwest. I study glacial deposits, but I'm a Christian. I'm active in the Lutheran Church, and I, over the my life as a Christian and my 15 years as a geologist, they have come to kind of talk to each other. That the way that I look at the earth as a geologist has been greatly affected by my Christianity, and my Christianity has been greatly affected by the earth. What I want to do today is to tell a story about the earth and our origins as a way to re-envision ourselves as part of the life system on this planet, part of the planet, part of the universe. We are connected to this in some kind of way. I think we're connected to the earth in, well, I want to do something before I say that. What I'd like to do, since it's not a tremendously huge group here, but I want to go around the room and maybe you could just say your first name and a place that you go to where you find yourself somewhat connected. You come to the mountains. I was up on Martin's Ridge last Sunday and this feeling of connection there. If just kind of quickly go around the room and...
To Earth, you mean?
Yeah. Some place that you like to go to. Let's have it a wild place, relatively wild place. Maybe it's a city park, too, where you feel like you go there because you get something. Why don't we start with you, Bill?
Well, it's here. No place else like here.
I'm Roxy, and I spent 2.5 hours folding clothes on Sunday after the clothesline. And I got it all. There's everything up there. It's wonderful.
I love very much the coast of Massachusetts and Cape Cod for very similar reasons to Holden, partly because to get to the remote island sort of areas in the Atlantic, you also get on a ferry and completely disconnect, leave everything across the water. And the ocean, like the mountains for me, has a restorative, plays a restorative role. Maybe even more in some ways than mountains, although if you can get the two together, then you're in heaven.
That's why Norwegians are so connected. They have the fjords, you know, they're right next to each other.
My name is Beverly, and I guess the place that I go like that is the Keys down in Florida. I do like the sound of the water.
My name is Bill, and I'll go anywhere to climb around the Roman ruin because I just love to sit and look down on it and think of all the people and the things that took place and put it into my own perspective of what am I doing here, all that went past, everything there. Or,
Ed?
Well, my name is Ed, and I live in Montana, We're the same kind of country as here, but my favorite fishing and hunting is just go up in the mountains. I say I go hunting, yet I don't even take a license with me because I don't like to kill. I don't like wild meat. But I love the fishing in the mountain lakes, and even if I don't catch any fish, which I often don't, just to go up there and be in the mountains and climb around and see that. That's
cutthroat trout.
Right. And brookies, the little brook trout.
My name is Donna, and a place that was really special to me was up in Alaska. It's kind of a bay and inlet, and there was a a grassy hill that you could go up on, and there was water all around, and then the mountains and the green and the snow. But since I can't trip off there every weekend, I like to go to the Oregon coast, and a place called Cape Lookout is really cleansing for me.
I'm Lori, and I have sort of the same experience as you. The place I felt the most connected was when I was in Zermatt, Switzerland, and it was sort of a place like this. You have to get on a tram, you leave your car, you get on this tram, you go up the mountainside, and there's no cars up there. I mean, it's a totally isolated place, and it's wonderful. But I guess if I'm talking about it here, I guess I'd have to say Hurricane Ridge up in the Olympics.
I'm Michelle, and for me it's northern Wisconsin and the Lake Country. It's my favorite spot.
My name is Carol. I live in the Bay Area in California, and I can get to the coast really easily, so I like the ocean. But of late I've gone up to what's called the Russian River area, which is just north of San Francisco by about an hour and a half. And it's very rural, countrified, and lots of butterflies and birds. And I go up to a little country house with a friend up there. That would be the place that I can go to the most often, and when I feel that I need to get out of the city, it's really wonderful. Peaceful.
Arlene, why don't you shut that off back there? It's in the back, on the far side, all the way down. Thank you. Jane?
My name is Jane, and we have nothing that's high or big in water in Texas, so I go to my backyard and I can get connected because we have beautiful sunrises and sunsets, and I live in one of three hills in Dallas. That's just park about every year, and it's beautiful in the Rockies.
Arlene?
Yes, I'm Arlene, and I am either in my house, not around a rural area, and it's very, it's a countryside, so I have the backyard, and I have like 120 acres of nothing, which is wonderful. But either that or when I go skiing up the peninsula, because that's, I can find some nice trails there, and I really feel close there.
I'm Chris. I live in Seattle, and there's hilly places right nearby where I live that are very refreshing for me to regularly visit and have views of the mountains and the water and local scenery. In my lifetime, I think the profound experience I had along that line was when I had a chance to kind of, so to speak, go back to my roots and be in the northern part of Sweden for a short time and get a sense of family connectedness as well as natural connectedness.
My name is Amelie, and about 5 years ago I took a hike toward Trinity Pass in the Lyman and above Lyman. There's this overlook, and it's really gorgeous, and that's what I love.
My name is Margaret. I live in Switzerland, and one of my favorite places is the cow patch in the Jura Mountains, overlooking Lake Geneva and the Alps and the Mont Blanc. And on a clear day, it just doesn't get any.
Well, I'm Rosalie Hansen from Seattle, and there are a couple places I love to go. If I can't go very far, I go about 10-15 minutes away to Golden Gardens in the evening to walk my shelters and to look at the sunset, sit on the rocks and take pictures and look at the sunset. And then if I have time, like on a weekend, can go away, I like to go up to Sandy Point Shores, 10 miles north of Bellingham, on a point up there, where you look at the, it's the head of the San Juan Islands. And you look at the to the west of the Olympic Mountains, and on the east you see, on the north, the back side, you see the Cascades and Mount Baker. And so it's beautiful all around you. Very peaceful, very good.
I'm Howard. I live in Seattle, and I get my connection in a daily walk in my neighborhood. And there's so much beauty around Seattle that frequently I go to other places, and then once a year come up here. And then someday I'm going to get back to the Canadian Rockies.
Mm-hmm. I'm Janet. I love to go up to Lake Superior on the South Shore where I grew up. And so being around water is very pleasant, restful for me. When I moved now to Hudson, which is along a river, the first place I sought out was a place down along the water, where I could just go by myself and just sit and hear the water.
We have to talk later. I spend my summers near Hudson. Hudson, Wisconsin. Wendy?
I'm Wendy, and I live here. And I feel connected to lots of things. Two in particular. My mountain is Bonanza. And I call it my mountain not because I have that mountain, but because it has me. And I look at it lots. Sometimes I go up to the second or third level, just specifically to sit there and look at my mountain. And the other place that I really love is Cloudy Pass.
I guess I can't quite choose. Probably two different things. One is my childhood home was on Lake Washington, and I always remember the sound of the water lapping on the shore as I would go to sleep. And then the moon rising. Oh, the moon rising in late August. It's huge golden color and shining across the lake. And always sunrise, because we face the east in the morning, the sun would rise over the water. We really love that. The other thing is, in our own backyard there in Parkland, Washington, are these ferns, are the sword ferns, mundane and boring as you could imagine. But I love those ferns because they're the ferns from my childhood. When we used to go up the ravines in the woods there, we'd build dams and then those streams and all those ferns. And those are sacred places. But they're almost completely only in the memory. That's sad too.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit of it still there in the backyard.
What we're doing is giving our name and talking about a place that we like to go where we feel kind of connected, a natural place. So.
My name is Neil. Well, I grew up in New York City, so there wasn't a lot in the way of trees or greenery. But the thing that stood out, as you were talking, I remember, was the stars at night. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mother used to make it a very special point to look at the stars at night and to have a conversation with them. Mm-hmm. These were basically, every star was an angel or an angelic intelligence of some kind, and had a personality. And I remember as sometime in adolescence, I can't remember if it's what she inspired me to do, but she said, well, I just felt I had to choose some stars as my stars, personal stars. And I just felt, I remember one night in my conversation with the sky, Pleiades sort of called for my attention. And I know I met a lot of people who actually sort of adopted them as favorites. And so whenever over my adult years I saw the Pleiades, I had a conversation or asked them for guidance or wisdom and inspiration. And since I've been living in Seattle, it's been really hard. It's one of the hardest parts of living in Seattle for me is I don't see the stars anymore. Very, very, very rarely. It's almost like something of a spirit, a spiritual aspect, the foundation of my life is something that's disconnected, and I feel like I'm withering on the bottom. Mm.
Interesting.
So when I came here, I kind of waited for the stars to come. That's okay. They were there last week. I want my stars back.
Last week. Don?
Are you supposed to say where we're from?
Oh, no, just your name and the place.
No, place. I have to say the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota always does it. I think of one night in particular where a friend and I just, for some reason, decided that we'd sleep across the river from where we lived. Stars are really clear, and they reflected in the water. Mm. It's like we were both canoeing through the stars. Mm. You couldn't distinguish the sky from the water. It's
like we're
across the sky.
Kate?
I live in lots of places. I guess I had an experience like you did when I was sailing in the ocean off of Key West, Florida.
Powder.
Experienced similar to Don's where I was sailing in the ocean out of Key West, Florida, and everyone else was asleep, and I was at the tiller by myself, and the stars in the Keys really come low in the ocean, and it was pretty sensational because I was by myself almost, and I couldn't see this ocean or the sky and tell them the difference because it's so black. Mm.
But I've lived lots of places that I like. I like Lake Superior, and I like out here in the mountains.
Are we giving our favorite outdoor place?
Mm.
Okay, well, I grew up on a farm, so I prefer the barnyard to the barn itself. I haven't traveled a great extent, but I know that the... I guess for me, when I need to regroup, I usually went down to the park in Toledo, the Metro Park, and did a lot of walking and a lot of searching there to be with nature, because it was a way to be at the university and also within 10 minutes to be totally away from the university. And I got a lot of strength there. And I spent a lot of my time in nature just being on a farm. I haven't done a great deal of traveling, but the Metro Park has always been a great place.
Christy.
So soon? I'm still thinking. My name's Christy, and, just one thing is I'm having various images pop into my mind that are both urban and natural. And that sometimes if I see, like going to the zoo in Washington, which is actually a nice zoo, there's something about kangaroos. You know, you can be out for a morning walk and you're sort of like in your routine, also you see this kangaroo hopping across the lawn and it just sort of flips you out. Because it just doesn't move like anything else you ever see.
If you don't live where?
If you're not in Australia. The other place that comes to mind is stargazing in northern Wisconsin in August when there's lots of shooting stars and sleeping out. Just it's like a movie, you know, that just hails across the sky.
I'm always reluctant to ask people to do this because it's clear that everybody likes to talk about their place. And it's really, but what it shows me, and the reason why I want to do this is that you don't have any, none of you have any hesitation at all at finding a place that you've been, a place on the earth, a place where you go, you know, yes, now I know a lot more about myself after being to this place where I'm centered. I get to do it too. I walk to school most days, and as I walk, my home lives in the my home is in the bottom of the Minnesota River Valley, and Gustavus is a city on the hill, and I climb up, and there's a sidewalk right up near campus where you kind of go up along the side of the valley, and every day you look across, and the sun is rising, or hasn't risen yet, or already risen, depending on what season it is, or there's green leaves on the tree, or no leaves, or there's snow or something, and every day you get just this different perspective rising up out of the valley. And that's a nice way to start the day. So there's something about the earth that we're already connected to. I want to suggest that we're connected to the earth in several different ways. We're well aware these days of our ecologic connections to the earth, more so than we were some time ago. We rely on other plants and animals, the biosphere, the hydrosphere, etc., for survival. I mean, that's kind of clear to us in the physical ecological relationship. We are also connected to the earth in an evolutionary sense, that we are in time the products of a whole sequence of beings that have been on this planet. The earth is 4.5 billion years old, and we are, as a species, 4 million years old. We're rather late on the scene, but we are connected to that whole history. We have eyes and ears and noses and blood and all this because we have inherited it from creatures that have developed it in the past. We are connected to that history. But we're also connected in a couple other ways, and this was the reason for asking you to get in touch with a special place. We're connected to the earth aesthetically. When you go up to Trinity Pass and look off, and you know, there's some aesthetic sense in you that gets turned. There's some recognition of when you look at a landscape, when you look at a tree, when you look at a glacier, look at a mountain, there's some recognition there of some truth and order that reflects on us. There's something that's beautiful about that. And lastly, there is a spiritual connection to the earth. We go into the wilderness, we go outdoors to ground our spiritual sense in many different ways. And I would like to talk a little bit more about that on tomorrow. These days, there is lots of evidence of our disconnectedness with the earth in all these four ways. We're disconnected ecologically. I don't know about evolutionarily, but we are disconnected aesthetically and spiritually. Maybe that too. Soon to disconnect ourselves. We have problems of acid rain, rampant materialism in our culture, a culture of convenience. We don't worry at all as a society about our soils eroding away at an extraordinary rate, or the rainforest being depleted, or the quality of our atmosphere destroyed. We have lapsed into, I think, a related area of distrusting or not liking work. We're lazy, and there is a kind of a rampant cynicism as well about life in our culture, particularly about the fate of the world. It's not okay at times in our society to wonder about the world. All these things, I think, are signs of our disconnectedness, our estrangement from these ways that we're connected. So I want to present a story here where we can identify ourselves as being part of this planet a little bit more. I want you to see yourselves as geology. If I were an astronomer, I'd say I want you to see yourselves as stars, because that's what we're originally. Stardust, the atoms that make up our bodies, were created in stars, explosions in stars. But we live on this planet, a rather unique planet, and we are an outgrowth of the shaping and the evolution of this planet here. We are one of the features on this planet. I want you to feel a need, a yearning to be connected with the planet, not out of a sense of shame or guilt, but out of a sense of desire, or love, or promise of passionate reunion. I want you to identify with the earth as some other that you want to be embrace again. So there's three things I want to talk about here. One is that the earth is alive in literal and figurative senses. Secondly, that we are geology, that we are phenomena on this planet. And thirdly, that there are spiritual dimensions to this. I'm going to talk about that more tomorrow. I have a session at 4:15. We'll get onto some of those topics today, certainly, unavoidably. But first of all, the earth is alive. The earth is constantly in motion. We are so limited by our senses. We cannot really appreciate. We need to, with the eyes of science and conversation and imagination, we can see the world to be the dynamic place as it is. Certainly we see earthquakes and volcanoes, all these kinds of things, but if we were able to somehow see on longer time scales, we would see the earth is constantly dynamic. When old people know this because they go back to their childhood homes and say, well, I remember when that tree was just this high, now it's this high. They can see those changes, those slow changes. You can't watch a tree grow, but you can see that it's grown. If our lifespan were 100 years or 1,000 years or, let's say, 10,000 years, you'd come into Railroad Creek Valley and say, gee, I remember when there were glaciers here. Or I remember when the slope of that mountain used to be here and now it's back here. Or I remember when that peak used to be this high and now it's this high. You'd be able to see those things. We don't live on those time scales, so we can't see those things, and we need to see them some other way by imagination, science, conversation. One thing that we have to realize is that we are limited by our senses. We are limited by our ability to believe what we see. I always have a problem when I see flies and they're about ready to eat your potato salad and they kind of go like this with their front paws. Or whatever they are. Their legs. Not an animal. And you look at that leg that's hair, about the size of a hair, and you go, there can't be a muscle in there that does this. There just can't. Or Dale Ostley was here last week, astrophysicist. And he talked about the fact that there are over a billion galaxies in the universe, and that every galaxy has 10 to 100 billion stars in it, each galaxy. And you just kind of get sick to your stomach. You go, oh, that can't be. It just can't be. I can't imagine that. Or when you think about the age of the Earth. There's an interesting story when geologists first applied the technique of radioactive dating. There was a big controversy about how old the Earth was because we had people that somehow got out of the Bible that the Earth was only 6,000 years old. Geologists said, no, it must be much older than that. It's probably hundreds of millions of years old. And then they designed the technique of radiometric dating using radioactive isotopes and predicting how old or measuring how old the Earth was. And the first measurements that they made, they found out that the Earth was billions of years old. And again, this kind of sick to your stomach feeling like, well, we're just nothing. We're just nothing in this scope of time. We can't conceive it. I can't believe that the Earth is 4 billion years old. I can't believe that the universe is that large. When any time you find yourself saying, I can't believe that there's a muscle in there, we are experiencing the limits of our own sensibilities. So we need to somehow go beyond those. We are limited by our minds, limited by our senses, but we should not be limited by our, we should not be, let those things limit our spirit for finding out what our universe is like, or what our earth is like. And again, it's through science but more important, or just as important, science is a way of orchestrating kind of communal imagination. People have ideas about the world, and they say, golly, I wonder if it's like this, or I wonder if it's like this. And you say, Bill, do you think it's like this? He said, well, no, I think it's like this. Well, let's see if we can come to, let's have a conversation and see if there's some way we can agree on it. And we have this conversation and imagination and the resulting story of somebody just going off with a checklist and saying, this is this rock, this is this rock. All scientific ideas go back to people with ideas, with intuition, with imagination and conversation. That's a very human creative process. Science has a bad name sometimes because science gets blamed for acid rain and global warming. So anyway, we need to remember that our earth, our senses and our minds are limited. Okay, time is, we have a long time on this planet, but not a long time in this session. I brought some slides down about just showing you pictures of the earth, that the earth is dynamic in many senses, in the volcanoes and glaciers and rivers and the wind, the atmosphere, the soil. Soil is wonderful. I don't know if I want to show those because I want to go on, and if we have a little time at the end, maybe I'll show them. The earth is alive in this kind of figurative sense that we can see movement. The more you think about this, there is less division between what is life and what isn't life. People are vegetarians because they can't stand the thought of killing this animal. But, you know, well, plants, I mean, we ate bread this morning, that's killing a living thing, and, well, there's a distinction. Well, what is the distinction? Then you get down and, well, what's the distinction between a plant and soil or rock, and it gets kind of fuzzy. I mean, everything seems to be moving and alive. There's even people would say today, some people would go so far to say that the earth is alive in a literal sense. There is a hypothesis called the Gaia hypothesis. Some of you have heard of that, spelled G-A-I-A. The product of the minds of a biologist named Lynn Margulis and a geophysicist named James Lovelock, that the Earth, in many ways, some would say really, and some would say epiphenomenally, alive, that the Earth has a way of regulating itself to maintain its status. It's interesting. Geologically, we know that the atmosphere and the oceans have been about the same for at least a billion years. There is something about, people would say that the organisms that have developed in the ocean and on the land live in such a way to control the composition of the atmosphere, the amount of carbon dioxide, the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere as a buffer so that the earth doesn't get too hot, the earth doesn't get too cold. If there's a climate change and the earth gets a little bit colder, there's a different type of biota comes up to kind of buffer that. We've been in this buffering system it's amazing how stable this has been. It's amazing the narrow window of range and temperatures that has been maintained on this planet for the last billion years. And people think that the earth is, in the same way that cells in our skin are one part of our body, we as creatures are one part of this organism, the Earth.
I just have a question. That Gaia hypothesis, doesn't it sort of reorient the thinking away from Darwinian competition too? Isn't there something about it?
That would definitely be an element of that too, that there is a mutuality, I'm searching for
cooperation.
That's the word I'm looking for. Among
it's
among
so hard
species.
To say in our society.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I don't think people would. The people that might say that the Earth really is alive as an organism would probably say that. I think people that would say that epiphenomenally it just appears that it's alive would say that it is a is a phenomenon of the Darwinian competition.
I think what the Gaia hypothesis does is set competition in the context of an overall cooperation.
Right.
Which is just like our own bodies. There are all these living organisms all over our skin and all inside us and everything. Mm-hmm. We are an ecosystem.
Yes.
And within us, there's this competition.
Mm-hmm.
And, certain cells fighting other cells. It goes on all the time. But if we remain healthy and alive, there's a kind of, I think the scientific term is a homeostasis. Mm-hmm. If there's about a kind of equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And we get sick when it gets off.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets real off, we die.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that, I think that's the Gaia hypothesis, that the Earth has that kind of, doesn't mean that there's not competition.
Right, exactly. But that's, I think it's, whether or not it's true that the Earth is really alive, I mean, that's a matter of question, but, and it's still open. But the, as an image, it's a beautiful image for us to have. We're talking this week about images of God. It's a wonderful way to re-image creation, the image of God as making this organism. So, this first point is the Earth is alive, active, dynamic, changing. The Earth has a history. It's changed through time. The Earth, a billion years ago, is different from it is today in some ways. It's not the same in other ways. There is a story to the Earth of which we are not insignificant. We are part of that story. We are the last chapter. We aren't the last chapter. We are the current chapter. The Earth will last for a few more billion years till the sun explodes. What's interesting is that when you look back, I want to talk more about this tomorrow, but
Don't worry, Jane, you won't be around.
Well, and I'm going to wait for tomorrow on that. The second point I want to make is that we are products of this process. We are a geologic phenomenon. The Earth moves in a certain way. The Earth creates. We're on the Earth. Life has sprung out of this planet. We are part of life. We are one of the characteristics of Earth. We're a unique planet. Many planets in the solar system, they're all different from each other. We're quite unique. There is a sense that the Earth wants to have life. That's rooted in physics and chemistry. I read an article, and maybe Bill could say something about this, about chemistry. The nature of organic molecules made of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen that make up most of what we would call living things. There is a stability to those molecules that seems to be just to predispose life, that they're just made to make life, that the organic molecules go together in a certain way, they're stable in a certain way, they're just perfect for making life. It's wonderful that God made carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, because it's so easy to have life from those things. When we look at physics and the theory of the Big Bang, which has been around now for almost 30 years as being the most believed theory for the origin of the universe, and there is quite a bit of evidence for it, that the atoms that make up our bodies, not just the atoms, but the protons, the electrons, and the neutrons that make up those atoms, they were created during the Big Bang. And they weren't right at the beginning. Who knows what's right at the beginning? Physics can take us back to very close to the Big Bang. They can take us back to less than a second after the Big Bang. They can take us back to, if you know scientific notation, 10 to the negative 35th second. Again, I can't believe that. But I mean, this is what the theories say. The theories work for all kinds of things in the universe. I always like to say, if you believe in toasters, you kind of have to believe in this, because it's the same rational process. People can't say, oh, I don't believe in that because I can't believe it. If this is called the argument from incredulity. I don't believe, I just can't imagine that. Well, you can imagine your toaster or your car or your microwave oven, and those are based on the same kind of scientific reasoning rationale that people have applied to studying the planet and the universe. So you can't just say you don't believe that, or else you have to give up
toasters,
microwaves, your cars, your shoes. I mean, you have to give up all kinds of things because it's just common sense reasoning in some ways. But anyway, we've gone back to that 10 to the negative 35th second. And at some point in the ensuing seconds, electrons, protons, neutrons were made. In that time also, the speed of light was decided upon. The speed of light is quite quick. I can never remember what it is. It's thousands of miles per second. You know?
186,000 miles per second.
186,000 miles per second.
I can't believe that.
The charge on the amount of the charge on the electron was decided in that first instant. Certain physical constants, Planck's constant, speed of light, etc., were decided upon the first. There could have been other values. There's nothing about them that says that the universe had to be, that electrons had to have that weight, that charge, that size, that speed. There's nothing about the universe that said it had to be that way. It was kind of decided that way. But that particular series of decisions has led directly to life. If you vary those weights, speeds, whatever, charges a little bit, you don't get life as we know it. You get something else. There's, again, a narrow window of limitless possibilities that the early universe seemed to have been threaded through. If it would have gone somewhere else in all these other possibilities, we wouldn't have life as we know it. Maybe we wouldn't have life at all, and then we wouldn't know it. Maybe there have been more than this universe. I mean, that's one of the theories of the Big Bang, that maybe it's going to come and you get what's called the Big Crunch, that everything collapses back and forth, and so maybe then you get another Big Bang. So maybe this is the second universe, or the third, or the hundredth, or the millionth, or maybe this is the billionth universe, and that each one has a different choice, and this one just happened to have those choices that give us life. But having said that, there is something about those choices that have produced life. It almost seems like with those choices, the universe has desired life. Life evolved on this planet. The first forms of life around 3 billion years ago. It took a while before life forms got really complicated, and now here we are, the crown of creation. We'll talk about that more on tomorrow. But there is evidence also that the reason why life didn't get started earlier on this planet was that we were still continually being bombarded by meteors. Meteor activity in the solar system was much more active in the first billion years than later. So it's kind of like life trying to get up and being thrown down. I mean, that's how much life wanted to get going, and it was sent back to the drawing board many times.
Organic life, right?
Organic life, yes, right.
Mm-hmm. Because according to what you said earlier,
this
already would be life.
Okay.
If the Earth is alive.
Let's say organic life, organic molecules. Okay. So, matter yearns for life. We are not only the gleam in our parents' eyes, but a yearn in the eyes of quartz and electrons and the Big Bang. The Earth is not merely a fertile garden that God made and then put humans on top because it's going to work and it's wonderful. God made the atmosphere out of oxygen so that we'd be able to breathe it when we got here. That's kind of a naive way to look at that. We are not frosting on the cake. We're not a later thought. We are sprung from this long history from 15 billion years ago when the Big Bang began. Bookstore commercial. I'm gonna one. A lot of what I'm saying is meant to be poetic in a sense, but it's all, what I like about it is that it comes out of the science too. It's a story using the science, and this book is kind of like that too. Brian Swimmy, he's associated with Matthew Fox, the creation spirituality guy, what he likes to see us as. Not only does the matter desire life, the universe desire life, but the universe desires consciousness, reflection. And after 15 billion years, the Earth has generated us so that the universe has eyes to look back on itself and to see how beautiful it is. Our responsibility is to see beauty. Let me just read a little bit of what we... what he says here. The elements were bestowed on us by the stars, the complex compounds given to us by the young earth, the informed sequences of the genes by the microorganisms, our limbs and organs by advanced life forms, and the linguistic symbols carrying our thoughts and feelings by the human venture. We could not see without the work of those who shaped the eye, could not hear without the work of those who shape the ear. The universe created these gifts, lavishing them upon us. Our first and deepest response is infinite gratitude. That which created all of this now desires our creativity, commitment, and labor, our delight in entering with full awareness of the cosmic story. The mountains and oceans, stars and life forms, all recipients of the same generosity. Contributors to the unknown future culminations of our work all tremble with the same power. He says the universe is a green dragon. Green because the whole universe is alive, an embryogenesis beginning with the cosmic egg of the primeval fireball, the Big Bang, and culminating in the present emergent reality. And a dragon, too, nothing less. Dragons are mystical, powerful, emerging out of mystery, disappearing in mystery, fierce, benign, known to teach humans the deepest reaches of wisdom. And dragons are filled with fire. Though there are no dragons, we are dragon fire. We are the creative, scintillating, searing, healing flame of the awesome and enchanting universe. I've read this three times. The first time I didn't like it. I had to take it with too much grain of salt. And then if you read it as poetry, it's very beautiful, I think. A new way to imagine us as being not merely in this instant of time, not merely in this speck of space, but as part of the wonderful and a very special part of a 15 billion year old, millions of light years broad universe that is beyond anybody's imagination. So that's why I say we are geology, we are eruptions on this planet, out of the planet. So, what do you think? Yes.
One of the things I haven't gone through Swim's book completely, but I actually started it. I can't remember what my responses were at the time. But I've read some other Christian writers who talk in not dissimilar ways about the universe, but the universe in terms of being, you know, the body of God or the body of Christ, instead of a dragon, an angelic body, celestial body. It seemed just more consistent with my own generation or my own upbringing. So I think, you know, my sense, there is a way to address it metaphorically and poetically. But if I look at it as a green dragon, to me it's almost reductionistic rather than enchanting or enlarging.
Yeah.
Coming from, you know, the culture I come from, perhaps the generation.
A lot of this, I think, has to rub against our sense of, well, certainly our the kind of Christianity that we learned in our growing up, and can be read certainly as disagreeing with that, as being an either-or situation. What I want to talk about tomorrow is those headbuttings, and if there's some way that we can live with that tension or resolve some of those differences. In many ways, this whole week is kind of about re-imaging the image of God, either through looking at stories of violence, looking at other religions that have sprouted forth on this planet, looking at historical criticism in the Bible, how to deal with the images we get in the Bible in general. Any other thoughts about this?
Let them eat toast.
Yeah, Neil.
Well, yeah, I guess I'll just put that in. When you talked about the beginning, the first millisecond or whatever billionth of a second, I remember a physicist once talking about that. And he said that what struck him, he was a physicist and a theologian, mm-hmm. that as far back as they were able to go, there was always a radical differentiation into, like you were describing, electrons and neutrons. In other words, there was some sense of designer and the desire of a designer in the choices that were as early as we can possibly even conceive or imagine.
I think it's beautiful, this idea of this narrow window, the smallest of possibilities that it took this route. You just think that somebody's got a little spin control there, that the logos is saying, let's go this way.
Yeah. 1 degree change
in
Mercury would be no life.
Yeah. But the downside of that is that if it had gone all these other possibilities, we wouldn't be here to know it. So we're here only because it did go that way. Kind of depressing.
Well, I remember when I was studying Hinduism, they have an idea that the universe is the body of God, and that God sort of is dreaming, and every once in a while wakes up and blinks. And when God blinks, all the universe is coming to being. Huh. And then when God's eye closes again, they all go back into the great dream of God.
That's interesting. The Big Bang is wild. There's some things that are really incredible about if you take these theories back to the Big Bang. One of the first things you might think is, what was there before the Big Bang? Was there some kind of space that this Big Bang happened and the universe expanding into? And the theory would say that, well, space was created at the Big Bang. That there was absolutely nothing, not even space, not even dimensions, not even nothing. I mean, there was absolutely nothing. And
sounds sort of like chaos without form and void, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yes. That's right.
God and darkness.
The other thing to say is that you can't say before the Big Bang, because the Big Bang was also the beginning of time. Time as we know it.
Our time.
Our time. That there was no period where nothing was happening. To say before the Big Bang is meaningless. There was no before. Time started then.